Hey, it's Stuart Harris from your weekly Constitutional. It's been a while. Well, 2020 is just the gift that keeps on giving. We haven't been able to produce any shows because the studio was small and Wayne and I are both old and kind of fat. So we're going to try today to do a brief interview, a regular sized interview with Wayne asking me questions so that we can enlighten you on what we see as today's pressing constitutional issues. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this time it's about 2020.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
I'm Wayne Winkler, the producer of your weekly Constitutional. Stuart and I have not been able to produce new programs since March because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The operation of WETS-FM and the operation of the Duncan School of Law have been affected by the pandemic, and we really had no choice but to suspend the production of this program until circumstances change. But today we have a special edition of your weekly Constitutional for WETS listeners. Before we get into that, I want to mention that WETS is holding its fall fundraiser this week. Our spring fundraiser coincided with the lockdown, so at the last moment we had to cancel having volunteers in the studio to answer telephones. We did what you might call a virtual fundraiser with online contributions only, and as we expected, that effort fell far short of our goals. This time we will have staff members answering phones from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. They'll all be in different parts of the building, and we're taking every precaution to keep our people safe. But this fundraiser has to be done. Listener support is the largest source of funding for WETS. Things are tight for public radio stations right now. I know things are tight for everyone, but a small contribution from everyone listening right now will go a long way toward maintaining this public radio service. You can make a contribution online at wets.org. And thank you. Today, Stuart Harris is connected to our studio via Skype. Stuart, have any significant constitutional questions come up in the last 8 months or so?
Good heavens, Wayne, where do I start?
Well, let's talk about an issue that was coming up early in the spring, about the time we had to stop production, and that is emergency powers. Does the Constitution give presidents and governors the power to impose restrictions on people, to make businesses closed, to require that people wear masks and other emergency measures?
It's a very constitutional question, Wayne. The national government is, as perhaps you recall from your eighth grade civics class, a government of limited enumerated powers. So the United States government can only do what it's authorized to do in the Constitution. Now, there are lots of powers there, and notably the commerce power has been used for Congress to enact statutes involving some degree of powers to regulate, to address public health emergencies. I mean, that's why we have a Centers for Disease Control and a Food and Drug Administration. But it's limited in what it can do. The national government is. State governments are very different. State governments, which, if you recall, preceded the national government. I mean, there were 13 states before there was a national government. These states are considered sovereign. And what that means is they have all the powers that any government has, except to the extent they're limited by the Constitution. And among those sovereign powers is something that we call the police power, which is interpreted as, generally speaking, being a power to protect the health and the welfare of the population. And that is why, Wayne, that most of the initiatives, most of the attempts to contain this pandemic have been on the state level. That's why you have, you know, Governor Cuomo giving press conferences rather, well, in addition to the things that President Trump has said, and other governors, Whitmer in our home state of Michigan has also been very active in this. So yes, the Constitution does have a lot to say about emergency powers. And in the case of public health emergencies, most of those powers reside in the states.
Is there any way a president could override a governor on that? For example, if a president wanted to order everyone to social distance and wear masks and close schools and things like that, and the governor said no, could the president override the governor's decision?
Not really. I mean, again, just taking Governor Whitmer as an example, if she's able within Michigan law to enact significant restrictions, then the president has little to say about that except except what he decides to tweet. On the other hand, note that I said within Michigan law. Recently, the Michigan Supreme Court interpreted Michigan law to limit the powers of Governor Whitmer to enact these emergency measures. But I emphasize that's all within the state of Michigan. It's all according to Michigan statutes and ultimately the Michigan Constitution. So no, President Trump does not have the power to countermand what a given governor might do. But what President Trump does have, which arguably he has not exercised, is the power to lead, the power to emphasize that we're going to address this pandemic on the basis of science and that we're going to make sure that personal protective gear is available to people, that we're going to make sure that reasonable social distancing and other things are going to be adopted by the national government, basically to set an example for the rest of the nation and perhaps to serve a coordinating function among the states. But ultimately, that's all the president can do because it's the states that have the power to protect their own people.
Of course, under ideal circumstances, the federal government can provide some much needed and much appreciated resources to the state governments with the access they have to scientists and experts at the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration and other agencies. They have the ability to provide a good working model for state governments to follow.
They definitely can. And kudos to the scientists and the career people at the CDC and the Food and Drug Administration and the National Institutes of Health. They have been trying mightily to do precisely that. Sadly, they have run into politics and they've run into a White House that is, again, I'm sorry to say, and I don't wish to be political. I simply want to state facts. A White House that does not seem concerned with the science and does not seem particularly concerned with protecting public health, but seems only concerned about the image that is presented for the incumbent president and the outcome of the imminent election. And that's a very sad thing. It's a very sad thing when our greatest institutions of public health are being undermined, undercut, and perhaps even corrupted by politics.
It's your Weekly Constitutional on WETS. I'm Wayne Winkler, the producer of the program. You usually don't hear me on the program. I kind of stay in the background and do the recording and twist the knobs here and there. Mostly, I just learn a lot, like you do. This is a program in which you can really learn a lot of things that are important, not only in history, but in today's world. And that's kind of what we're doing in this special program. It's been a very interesting year, and today I'm talking with Stuart Harris via Skype, kind of getting caught up on all the different constitutional issues that have come up in the last several months. But this is fundraising week at WETS, and it's important that you support this public radio service. Truth is the essence of the coverage and programs you've come to count on from WETS, especially in this year of so many extraordinary events with such unprecedented impacts, and more surely to come. This year's not over yet. Staying well and accurately informed has never been so necessary to the daily lives of everyone in our community, to the decisions our families must make, and to the very health of our democracy. Through a daily lineup of fact-centered news coverage, insightful conversations, essential context, and extensive local reporting from our own newsroom, WETS connects you with the heartbeat of our world like no one else can. But the crucial central fact of the matter is that WETS has the power to inform only because you make it possible through your membership support. So please do your part and give now. Make an online contribution at WETS.org.
Folks, I know from direct discussions with Wayne that he is operating on a shoestring. He is doing much more with much less, and he needs your help. So please, please, I know you're all stressed now and you're all worried about your jobs and you're worried about your income and you're worried about your kids, you're worried about everything. But now is the time to step up and support this wonderful radio station that you have in East Tennessee, WETS. So please, please, please go to WETS.org and be as generous as you believe you can, because this is important stuff we're talking about and we can only do it with your support.
You hear empowering reporting and analysis all across the day on Public Radio's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You hear it in the extended and insightful conversations on Here and Now, 1A, and Fresh Air. This commitment to reporting the facts for everyone in our community and to demanding fairness, transparency, and accountability from the powerful is Public Radio's responsibility to you and all the people who live here. It guides our coverage every day. Your civic need for accurate information in this election year is critical. But what's especially forceful in this information equation is the power of support like yours to fund the essential coverage and programs on WETS. Member support, your support, is by far the largest portion of WETS-FM's budget. That's why I ask you to donate today to help support WETS and the reporting that you will count on so much in the crucial weeks ahead. Make an online contribution to support WETS at WETS.org. I'm Wayne Winkler, the producer of Your Weekly Constitutional, and I'm talking with our host, Stuart Harris, via Skype, about some of the things that have been going on during this year, particularly in the months that we have been unable to produce new programs. And I want to talk about some of the events that took place in Portland, Oregon, a few weeks ago. There were some disturbances in Portland, and apparently unidentified federal troops came in and snatched some people, took them off to who knows where, and it raised a lot of constitutional questions. Can the federal government send in troops or federal law enforcement agents into a community to enforce local laws? Is that constitutional?
Well, Wayne, yes, they can, but in very, very limited circumstances. In the United States, the civilian government controls the military, and the military is a force designed to protect us against foreign threats, not against domestic threats, except in the most extreme of circumstances. And those extreme circumstances are referenced in something called the Insurrection Act, which was adopted, I believe, in roughly 1804. Forgive me if I don't know the exact date. It was early 19th century. It's only been invoked rarely. I think the last time before 2020 was during the Rodney King riots in 1992. And it's typically only been invoked when the governor of a state asks the president for assistance. But it can be invoked without that request, and it can be invoked over even the protests of a governor. And that is, in some sense, legal, but it's also very, very troubling. It's almost the definition of a police state when you have the military regulating its own people, which is what many senior members of our military have mentioned. They have suggested that they never thought that they would ever be deployed to coerce their own people who were trying to engage in peaceful protest. A right which is guaranteed by the First Amendment, both speech and assembly. So any deployment of the United States military, whether the regular military or even federalized National Guard forces, these are extremely troubling and should only be done in the most extreme of circumstances. And that's why Portland is so, or was so, controversial. I mean, you had the governor of Oregon, you had the mayor of Portland, you had them all saying, we don't want federal interference here. We don't want federal forces here. And yet our president sent them in. That was a very, very troubling circumstance.
So federal personnel and military can come into a local situation to keep the order if they are requested by local authorities. For example, in July of 1967, when there was civil unrest in the city of Detroit, Governor George Romney asked President Lyndon Johnson to send in troops, and he did. But in September of 1957, when federal courts had ordered the schools of Little Rock, Arkansas to desegregate, federal troops wound up coming in there, and that was not at the request of local authorities.
That is another notable use of federal power in contradiction to state power. That was a use of the federal power to enforce a federal court order. A United States District Court had ordered the public schools of Little Rock to integrate, and they had started to do so until the governor showed up and prevented them from doing so, and actually brought out his National Guard, his Arkansas National Guard, and the National Guard prevented African-American students from integrating Little Rock High. And that was when President Eisenhower, to his great credit, nationalized, federalized the Arkansas National Guard, ordered them back to their barracks, and then sent in the 101st Airborne and said, this federal court order will be enforced. And that was a very strong exercise of both judicial review, which means the power of a federal court to order us to do things. The president was supporting that. And also the Supremacy Clause, which in Article 6 of the Constitution, which says that federal national law shall be supreme over state law. So that was another exercise of the national power in, I think, and I suppose, and I hope that most Americans think, is an appropriate way to make sure that a federal court order to integrate the Little Rock Public Schools was followed.
Well, I'm sure that the governor of Arkansas and the people of Little Rock in Arkansas immediately saw the error of their ways and approved of this action, didn't they?
No question about that. Yeah, Orville Faubus, who was the governor, the rest of them saw the light, and everything after that was sunshine and unicorns. No, of course not. This was a dispute that continued on for the next 20 years and arguably to this day. It was part of something called massive resistance to integration. And the sad fact is that after all of those efforts and all of that confrontation, we in the United States in 2020 have public schools that are in many respects just as segregated as they were back in the late 1950s.
It's your Weekly Constitutional on WETS. I'm Wayne Winkler, the producer of the program, talking with the host, Stuart Harris, via Skype. And this is the fundraiser week at WETS, a time when we ask our listeners to make a contribution to support this public radio service. WETS provides a valuable community service with in-depth coverage of local and regional news, including those issues that affect your daily life. When you need answers about voting in your community, the latest information on schooling options, safety and requirements, or community health policies, you'll find them here on WETS. It's important that you know more than just the basics. You need the entire story. WETS will continue to go above and beyond to provide you with in-depth answers, relevant discussions, and always the most accurate information. We are still in this together. With your support, WETS will continue this vital service to you and everyone in the Tri-Cities region as 2020 finally draws to a close and 2021 starts fresh. Make your contribution to this vital local service today.
I completely concur, Wayne, and to listeners, I say thank you for listening. We love you. You're why we do what we do. But get on the internet and make a damn contribution.
You can contribute on our website at wets.org.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. It's the Pledge Drive. And in this moment when Red State America and Blue State America do not seem to agree even on the most basic facts on any of the issues facing our country, immigration or any of the others, on this radio station, on public radio, we think it's important to try to carefully and truthfully document and analyze what is actually happening in this country. One thing I think about all the time is how we now live with a vast alternate news media that is not fact-based, but propaganda for a political position. And the people on the non-factual side, they see this as a war. They're frank about that. They see it as an information war, they see it as a political war, and they have organized money and resources for that war. And I think that it's a problem that those of us in the fact business,
people like me, like everyone in mainstream journalism, we usually do not think of it as a war. We don't treat it as a war, but it is a kind of war. And if you want independent reporting that truly looks at the facts, we need you on our side. You can sit this war out, or you can pick a side with your dollars. Support independent, fact-based reporting on this radio station. Here's how to pledge.
Make an online contribution today at WETS.org.
$10 might seem like a small amount, but when you sign up as a monthly sustaining member, that $10 helps pay for daily broadcasts of Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all of the news and information you hear on WETS. You get a lot for your monthly contribution. And we need that gift right now to keep bringing you all the programs you count on. $10 makes a big impact. We combine it with contributions from your fellow listeners. Public radio only works with you. Contribute now at WETS.org.
You're listening to a special fundraising edition of Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Wayne Winkler, the producer of the program, talking with Stuart Harris via Skype today. And this, as I said, is a special fundraising edition, which is only being heard on WETS. The other stations around the country that carry the program are taking a rebroadcast, as we have been doing since we stopped production in March. We're looking forward to getting back to work and producing new programs, but we thought we would take this opportunity to just kind of do a recap of some of the constitutional questions that have come up since the pandemic kind of forced everyone into a different way of life. One issue that is on everyone's mind currently is the Supreme Court. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away on September 18th, with the election just weeks away, and Donald Trump was very quick to name a replacement. In 2016, Justice Antonin Scalia passed away in February, almost a year before the inauguration of a new president. But the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, said that the people should decide. It was so close to the election that it would only be right to wait until after the election to let the new president make that decision. Now, of course, many people have pointed up the hypocrisy of that position, that when it's President Obama, it's too close if it's almost a year, but just weeks away from an election in 2020, the Senate Majority Leader sees no problem with rushing through an appointment, and they had one ready to go and are actually discussing it right now. Now, of course, this goes against any notion whatsoever of fair play, and the Republicans can expect that the Democrats will pay them back if and when they are in a position to do so. This will not be forgotten. But, as President Trump pointed out, he won the election, and elections have consequences. The point here is that the president is within his or her right to make such an appointment, no matter how close to an election or an inauguration it is. And as unfair as it might seem, it is constitutional. The difference here is that Donald Trump has the support of the Senate and Barack Obama did not. And although Donald Trump is known for stretching the truth quite often, he was dead on accurate by saying elections have consequences. So we have a situation that is certainly not right, but it is constitutional.
It is definitely constitutional for the Senate to do whatever the Senate wants to do. Article 1 gives the Senate the sole power to govern itself. So as I've said many times, Mitch McConnell was within his constitutional power when he refused to even consider Merrick Garland, who was eminently qualified for the court, who was a centrist, a moderate nominee, who had served not only as a federal judge on the D.C. Circuit, but as a prosecutor in the Oklahoma City bombings cases. He was a great candidate by almost any measure, and yet Senator McConnell refused even to consider him. So you can decide for yourself whether you think that was right, but in terms of the Constitution, it was within the Senate's constitutional power. Fast forward to today, it's also within the Senate's constitutional power to confirm Amy Coney Barrett as quickly as it wishes to. Is it right? Is it hypocritical? Those are distinct issues. The suggestion that there is some sort of rule or some sort of norm that you don't confirm a Supreme Court justice in an election year, that's smoke and mirrors. That's subterfuge. It's gone both ways over the course of our history, and it all boils down to whether the Senate wants to do something. And right now, the Senate wants to confirm Judge Barrett. And if that's what the Senate wants to do, that's what the Senate will do, and there's nothing that anyone else can do about it.
What exactly does the Constitution say about the Supreme Court? How much detail does it go into?
Not a lot. It simply says there shall be a Supreme Court, and that there shall be a Chief Justice of the United States, and that Congress shall have the authority, the power, to create other courts, and, you know, therefore other judges. Well, the Congress has always exercised that option, going back to the first Judiciary Act of 1798, and has created a Supreme Court, and it's populated it with various numbers of justices. I think the first court had either five or six justices, and then the number of those justices varied all throughout the 19th century up until 1869, when the number was settled at nine. And that's why we have nine justices today, and that has lasted since 1869. But there's nothing in the Constitution that says we can't change that number. It's been done several times in our history. Even the so-called court packing plan of the 1930s, 1937, when Roosevelt was elected to his second term, any objections to that are political objections. They are not constitutional. It was perfectly constitutional for President Roosevelt to suggest, as he did, that you increase the number of Supreme Court justices. I believe in his case, it would have possibly gone up to 15 justices. But politically speaking, it was very controversial. And similarly, any attempt by the Democrats, assuming that they win both the presidency and the Senate and maintain their majority in the House, any attempt by them to do something similar would be politically controversial, but it would be perfectly constitutional.
But on a practical level, if the Democrats, for example, said they wanted to increase the number of justices to 15, the Republicans could come back when they have the advantageous position and say, well, we're going to make it 25, or maybe they could cut it down. Well, I don't think they could really cut it down, could they? I mean, these justices are appointed for life.
Cutting it down presents a problem because, of course, Article 3 says that justices, or all federal judges, quite frankly, are appointed for good behavior, which effectively means for life. So cutting down the federal judiciary is difficult, at least in the immediate term. You might have to cut them down prospectively and allow, you know, sitting judges to retire until you reached your desired number. But increasing the number, 25, 50, 100, I mean, that could all be done, absolutely. It would assume, of course, that the Republicans had control of both the presidency and the entire Congress. I mean, that's the necessity, isn't it? I mean, if you're going to pass a federal statute, you basically need both the president and the Congress. So that's why people are talking now, hoping, and on the Democrats' part, that they do have such control. They're talking about what politically seems like a radical action, but constitutionally is quite routine. That is simply to increase the number of judges on the Supreme Court, and perhaps even the total number of judges in the federal judiciary. There are perfectly reasonable arguments that that's appropriate. The federal judiciary is overtaxed and underfunded, and I have long felt that there are too few federal judges to handle their caseloads. So on a perfectly neutral basis, a Congress could increase the number of federal judges, and effectively then that would give the ability to fill those seats to a Democratic president and a Democratic Senate. It's all political, Wayne,
yeah,
and it's a question of how people react to it. I mean, let's just play the game. Let's assume that the polls are correct. They show Biden with more than a double-digit lead and with significant leads in almost all of the swing states, and indeed including some states that are in play that nobody anticipated, like Texas and Georgia and Iowa. Let's just assume that the polls are correct. Let's assume that Biden takes the presidency in overwhelming electoral vote. Let's assume that the Senate goes the same way and the Democrats have an absolute majority, plus, you know, Kamala Harris is a vice president to break any ties. they have an opportunity at that point to effect very significant change. Whether they seize that opportunity or not is a matter of political calculation. On the one hand, these opportunities come along rarely, and you should do what you need to do. You should act as aggressively as the Republicans have acted in terms of the federal courts, in terms of other things. And so there's that argument. You should act as aggressively as you can while you have the power and effect systemic change that will redound into the future. The opposite argument is that if you go too far, if the public perceives you as being too radical, well, then guess what? There's another election in 2022.
Well, we still have an election to get through in 2020, and it's coming up just a few days from now, and we'll be talking about some of the issues surrounding this election in just a few moments. I'm Wayne Winkler, the producer of Your Weekly Constitutional, and today I'm talking with Stuart Harris, the host of the program, via Skype, and we're talking about some of the things that have come up during 2020. And we're talking about some of the constitutional questions that have come up in 2020. You hear empowering reporting and analysis all across the day on WETS-FM's Morning Edition and All Things Considered. You hear it in the extended and insightful conversations convened on Here and Now, 1A, and Fresh Air. This commitment to reporting the facts for everyone in our community and to demanding fairness, transparency, and accountability from the powerful is WETS-FM's responsibility to you and to all the people who live here. It guides our coverage every day. Your civic need for accurate information in this election year is critical, but what's especially forceful in this information equation is the power of support like yours to fund the essential coverage and programs on WETS. Member support. Your support is by far the largest portion of WETS-FM's budget. That's why I ask you to donate today to help support WETS and the reporting you'll be counting on so much in the critical months ahead. Make your online contribution now at WETS.org.
2020 has already proven to be an eventful year, and you've been able to depend on WETS to keep you up to date. From national, local, and international news about COVID-19 to the presidential primary race. And while it's free to tune, stream, or read this news, it takes real financial resources to make it a reality. Your support is truly critical.
When you become a WETS sustaining member, you'll never need to worry about when your membership expires. Once you set it up, your membership is always up to date. No more wondering, when was the last time I sent a check? No renewal notices in the mail. And you can contact us at any time if you need to make changes to become a sustaining member. Think about how much WETS is worth to you. Pick a monthly amount, grab your credit card, and set up your sustaining membership in just minutes at WETS.org. Do it now, and rest assured you're doing your part to support our station.
We do appreciate your support, and remember, your support helps keep programs like Your Weekly Constitutional on the air. Now, Stuart, we're going to come back to the election of 2020, which has been unprecedented. That's about the only word I have for this election. Let's go back a few weeks to a statement that the president made that the election might be delayed for one reason or another. It was interesting because Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, usually backs whatever play Donald Trump is making, but he did not stand with him on this. He said the election would be held on November 3rd. We would be inaugurating a president on January 20th. Is it possible for a president to actually delay an election?
No, it is not possible for a president to delay an election. What it is possible is for the president acting with Congress, with a majority in both houses, to change the law that sets the date of the election, because the Constitution gives the political branches, president and Congress, the ability to set that date. In fact, the president and the Congress have set those dates. They've set November 3rd as the election date. They've set December 14th as the date that the various states have to send their electoral votes to the District of Columbia. They have set January 6th 2021 is the date when the Senate will open and count those votes. And this all is aimed toward making sure that we have a president-elect before January 20th, when the Constitution, the 20th Amendment specifically, says that we have to inaugurate a new president. So can those preliminary deadlines be rescheduled? Sure. But just as the court packing plan of the 30s was controversial politically, any such changes in the current electoral schedule would be extremely controversial. And I believe that's why people like Senator McConnell have said that they're going to support the existing schedule.
Stuart, we have had several guests on this program who have talked about one aspect or another of Abraham Lincoln's presidency and his relationship with the Constitution. He was a president who, I think it would be fair to say, was known for kind of interpreting the Constitution in whatever way he needed to. And if he didn't break it, he maybe bent it ever so slightly. But if there was ever a president who had not only the reason but the ability to delay an election, it would have been Abraham Lincoln in the 1864 election. We were in the midst of a civil war. He was also in the midst of a campaign that he truly believed he was going to lose. But even with all that going, even with a national emergency like the Civil War, where a president could be excused probably by history for delaying an election, the election went on as scheduled. Abraham Lincoln did not delay the election.
He did not. The Civil War was arguably the greatest crisis in our history. Abraham Lincoln sat in a capital city, the District of Columbia, that had been almost surrounded the year before in 1863, when the Confederate armies had gone as far north as Pennsylvania and might have completely cut him off from the north. He was in a very perilous situation. The existence of the Republic hung in the balance. The casualties kept mounting, and the war kept grinding on. And Lincoln himself, faced with a very strong candidacy by one of his former commanding generals, a fellow named George McClellan, thought that he might very well lose the presidency. And yet, there was little or no consideration of postponing that election. They held an election in the midst of a war, and incidentally, with lots and lots of mail-in ballots from the Union Army, and Lincoln won re-election. Similarly, in 1944, Franklin Roosevelt, who was up for his fourth term as president — this was before the Constitution was amended to prevent such things — in the midst of perhaps the most terrible war, the most decisive war, the most important war in the history of the planet, World War II, he was faced with a re-election campaign. And there was no suggestion, as far as I can tell, by anyone that he should postpone it or simply say, no, I'm too busy. We're in the middle of a crisis and I'm just going to stay president till the war is over. That didn't happen. He put himself up for re-election, and the people had a choice, and we had free and fair elections. And those are two critical moments in our history when we went ahead just as scheduled. And I think there's even less justification today to even consider postponing an election. Could we do it? Sure. But it's not a good idea.
Okay, it's a pretty safe bet to say that Election Day will be held on November 3rd as scheduled. But what about finding out the results? There are any number of things that could delay the actual counting of the votes. Is there any constitutional guidance on that?
Oh, Wayne, yes. I've actually just been working on a piece that will appear in the Knoxville Bar Association's journal in late October. And I think the title of my piece is So What If? Because that's what everyone's been asking me. What if this? What if that happens? What happens next? So let's talk about some of the what ifs that we've encountered recently with COVID-19. President Trump, as of the time we're speaking, has just been released from the hospital. He's not out of the woods, as his doctor says, and may very well have to be rehospitalized, and perhaps, heaven forbid, like Herman Cain, he may take a turn for the worse and ultimately die. what happens immediately if a president is dead or is debilitated, you know, is on a ventilator and can't exercise his duties? Well, the 25th Amendment handles that. And to oversimplify, basically the vice president would take over for some period of time, at least until whatever disability existed was reversed. I'm skimming over a lot of details here that might happen, might not happen very smoothly if Trump refused to allow it to happen. But that's basically what the 25th Amendment is for continuity of government in the event that the president is either dead or debilitated. But I haven't gotten to your question yet. What about the election? Okay. Well, the Constitution sets up the general parameters for presidential elections, but leaves a lot of discretion to the states. What are these parameters? Well, the Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution sets up something called the Electoral College. The 12th Amendment amends to some extent how that college operates, but what it boils down to is this: when you vote for president, you're not really voting directly for that president, you're voting for a slate of so-called electors in your state. And your state gets a total number of electors equal to its number of representatives in the House and its number of senators. So bigger states tend to get more electors than smaller states. So your vote gets cast on November 3rd. Then the states have about 6 weeks to figure out exactly which electoral votes it's going to send off to Washington. And by December 14th, it has to do so. And so every state has sent in a slate of electors on December 14th, and then a couple of weeks later, on January the 6th, those votes are counted by the Senate of the United States, and a winner of the election is declared. That's the general parameters. Well, a couple of others. The end point is January the 20th, which was established by the 20th Amendment. And so that's the general outline. We've got this thing called the Electoral College. We've got a hard deadline of January 20th to inaugurate a new president, but we've got preliminary deadlines between November and January when various things are supposed to happen. Well, given that timeline, it really depends a lot on, you know, who, what, and when. Either of the major party candidates could be either dead or debilitated as of November 3rd. What happens if one of those candidates dies? The parties themselves certainly can nominate somebody else to replace them. Parties have done that. I mean, the Democratic National Committee nominated Sergeant Shriver to replace Thomas Eagleton in the 1972 election, but that was 3 or 4 months before the general election. Now, I mean, we're within a month.
People have already voted.
Oh, that's a great point, Wayne. I mean, we have this thing called early voting now. So not only would there be an issue to, you know, how could we reprint the ballots, which we probably couldn't, but what about the people who have voted? What if I voted for, you know, Donald Trump and he dies in the meantime and then the party nominates somebody else? Should my vote then just be transferred to the party's nominee? Huge issue. So dying before the election is a bad, bad thing. But what if we have the election? But then during the period, which, you know, in, you know, November and December, when the states are deciding how to allocate their electoral votes, and they have all kinds of freedom as to how they do that, they typically follow the popular vote, but they don't have to. You know, what happens then? If let's take an example with our home state again. You know, the polls all indicate that Biden is significantly ahead in that state. Let's say he wins the popular vote, but then, you know, on November 4th or 5th, he keels over from coronavirus. Could happen. So now you've got a popular vote in the state of Michigan for Biden, and presumptively he's going to get all those electoral votes, except for the fact that he's dead. So what does the Michigan legislature, which is a Republican-controlled legislature, what does it do then? Well, maybe it says, well, you know, we didn't anticipate this. We're just going to give all of our electoral votes in Michigan to Trump. Could happen. I mean, we don't know what's supposed to happen then. We do know that the state of Michigan has the power to allocate its electoral votes. So, you know, you could have, arguably, you could have two slates coming from the state of Michigan up to the United States Senate. You could have one that was authorized by the legislature. You could have one that was authorized by Governor Whitmer through her Secretary of State, who's in charge of counting the votes in that state. And then the president of the Senate, who is also confusingly the vice president of the United States, would have to then decide, you know, which of those two slates of votes to count on January the 6th, 2021. So the only thing you can say about all of this is that if somebody dies between now and January 6th, there are going to be lawsuits. There are going to be delays. There's going to be confusion. There's going to be rancor. There are probably going to be protests in the streets. Thank heaven that if we get to the point of, you know, an electoral vote that is clear and we get past January 6th and there is a president-elect, well, then the 20th Amendment comes to the rescue and it says in the event that the president-elect dies, well, then the vice president will be sworn in. And indeed, it further says that if the president-elect has yet to qualify, that the vice president will be sworn in as acting president. So it gets a bit smoother after January 6th. So the great danger is now until January 6th, if one or both of these candidates is incapacitated or dies, we're in a world of hurt.
We're touching on just a few of the problems that could occur during this election. However the election turns out, there's a high probability of lawsuits by candidates, by states. It's certainly possible we would see this election decided in the Supreme Court as we saw 20 years ago.
I think you're probably right, Wayne. So then add one other complicating factor, the peaceful transfer of power. Our current president is the first president, certainly in my lifetime and maybe in all of American history, to refuse to commit himself to the peaceful transfer of power. And that's a very, very frightening thing. I often tell my students that I can get a little bit teary-eyed when I hear the Pledge of Allegiance or when I hear the national anthem. But the day that I almost always get teary-eyed is Inauguration Day, because that's the moment in which we differentiate ourselves from all of the authoritarian regimes that have existed in history. That's the day when one very powerful man, and eventually a woman, surrenders all of that power to another person, sometimes with great misgivings. Think back to 1992. We had a hard-fought presidential race between George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, members of opposite parties, each of whom disliked the other and thought the other was going to be bad for the country. Bill Clinton won. And you can imagine how upset George H.W. Bush must have been. But he was a very honorable man. And there was never any question from him that he would fail to honor that electoral result. And so he continued to serve, and he served well between November and January. And then on the appointed day, he behaved with great dignity and decorum. And he rode with Clinton in a limousine down Pennsylvania Avenue to the Capitol and did what must be a horribly difficult thing. That is, he stood there and watched his opponent take the oath of office. And he handed over the reins of power to a person who had defeated him in an election. And that was the moment that our American Republic was demonstrated to the whole world. This is how we do things here. We do not have wars. We do not have coups. We do not have the army coming in and telling us who our leader was going to be. This is the American experiment. And the American experiment is that we govern ourselves and we believe in the rule of law. That's why it's so troubling that our current president has been asked repeatedly whether he will commit to a peaceful transfer of power, and he has refused to do so. And that is perhaps ultimately the great issue of January 2021, is regardless of what the Supreme Court says, regardless of what the Electoral College says, regardless of the popular vote, will our current president leave the White House?
Does the Constitution give us any direction on that, or were the framers of the Constitution just completely unable to imagine such a thing taking place?
I think most of the framers would not have even considered that a president would fail to leave. There are two possibilities in terms of 2021. If there's a very clear electoral vote in favor of Biden, it would be very difficult for Trump to stay, because the Secret Service Those are the guys who are immediately in the president's vicinity, and they're all packing heat. They've all got guns. Those guys are sworn to protect the president. And if the Secret Service believes that we have a new president, well, then the old president's not going to get to stay in the White House. But if there's a very close vote, and if the result is tied up in the Supreme Court, and there is no clear outcome, then we're in maximum danger, because then Trump could claim that he was the actual winner and that he was going to stay in the White House. And then it's a question of, what does the Secret Service believe? And I'm sorry to say it, but what does the military believe? I hate to involve the military in this discussion at all. The military is not supposed to be involved in politics. I was in the military. I was commissioned in the same ROTC unit that Mark Milley, our current chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was commissioned in. He was a senior when I was a freshman. I don't know if I ever even met him, but we were in the same program. And one thing that we were taught was that the role of the military in American politics is zero. Zero. The military is not supposed to be involved. But sadly, it may boil down to whom the military follows.
Clearly, there's going to be no shortage of constitutional issues coming up in the next few months, and we can hope that listeners to this program will have a little better idea of what the Constitution has to say about things, and sometimes more importantly, what the Constitution doesn't say about an issue.
Well, I hope so, Wayne. I hope that longtime listeners have gained some degree of knowledge from our show. That's why we do what we do. And I want to apologize to all of our listeners that we have been off the air for so many months during what is arguably the most critical period in recent history in American constitutional law. I've gotten many emails and Facebook messages to that effect. You know, we really need you now. And I felt bad about it because we haven't been able to produce new shows. We work in a tiny studio. You're a big guy. I'm not so big, but between the two of us, we fill up that place. And we're both older and heavier, and we're both men. And those are three risk factors that we share with the president, interestingly enough. And, you know, in our families, we have people who are immune compromised or perhaps elderly. And so out of an abundance of caution, we have not gotten together in our studio. And even our interview today is being done via Skype, which gives us somewhat less sound quality than we would otherwise have. But it's just hard. It's just hard to produce a radio show in these circumstances and unsafe. So I don't know when we'll be able to get back to regular production. I hope that we can relatively soon. And I certainly apologize to all of our listeners that we've been sort of missing in action up till now. And I hope this episode helps to elucidate some of these issues that are so important for our constitutional democracy.
You've been listening to Your Weekly Constitutional on your public radio station, WETS-FM, in Johnson City, Tennessee. I'm the producer of the program, Wayne Winkler, talking with the host of the program, Stuart Harris, via Skype. And we've been covering some of the constitutional issues that have come up in the last several months since we've been unable to produce new programs. I want to remind you that public radio and this program in particular are supported through the contributions from listeners just like you. You are the most important source of funding we have, not only the largest source of funding, but the most stable, the one that is the most reliable. You can make your contribution to WETS at our website, wets.org. And Stuart, I'm going to hand it back to you for our standard closing.
That's our show. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.